secure attachment is developed through the experience of rupture and repair. Secure attachment is formed when they wake up, they're alone in their crib. Where's mama? Where's daddy? They cry, we come. They're out there walking in the backyard. They fall down and scrape their knee. They cry, we come. It is the consistency. We are so consistent that we are there when they fear that we're not. We are there. We step in. And when they get angry, we're still there. And when they get sad, we're still there. And when they mess up, we're still there. And this is what our couples experience too.
Welcome to the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast, where we explore the journey from heartbreak to healing and transformation. Here are your hosts, Chris Rocha and Jen Howie.
Hey everyone, welcome to the conversation. Welcome back to the podcast. We have taken the summer off, had about a 3-month break, and we've been busy and doing all the summer things, and now it's happy fall, y'all. How are you, Jen?
I'm good, Chris. I actually am pretty good. I can't complain.
Good.
Well, working on, you know what I'm doing? I'm working on living in the moment, living in the present, because there's nothing I can do outside of the present. So that is my focus right now. So I can legitimately say I'm good.
Excellent. I love that. I also love that we're friends, that we can go almost all summer without having a whole bunch of interaction and pick up right off where we pick up where we left off. Appreciate
hardly,
that about
we
us.
We hardly spoke this summer. Yeah. It's been
after
busy.
30 years, we were busy doing good things.
Yeah.
So, well, Jen, I'm excited about today because not only is this topic so critical in what we do, but we love our guest. So who do we have on the podcast today, Jen?
We have an okay guy on the podcast today.
He's pretty okay.
We have Dr. Jake Porter. He is the founder and president of Daring Ventures, a leading counseling and coaching organization that specializes in trauma, betrayal recovery, and addiction healing. He holds a doctorate of professional counseling and is a licensed professional counselor. He's also a certified sex addiction therapist, as well as a supervisor and a leader in attachment-based recovery work. And we are thrilled to have him here today. He is more than an okay guy.
Yeah. Jake is also widely known for helping couples understand how attachment wounds impact their relationships and how healing those wounds creates lasting connection and trust. So today we're exploring what attachments really, what does it mean? What is it? And how it shapes recovery, how couples can move from disconnection towards safety and intimacy. So Jake, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me back. I'm just grateful to be here with y'all. Y'all are awesome, both of you.
Thank you. Well, we make a nice trio, don't we?
Absolutely.
We think you're awesome too.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, hopefully your summer was good as well.
Hot. Yeah. It was hot. It's always hot in Houston.
Yeah.
But good. It was a good summer. A lot of sweet moments. Coming out off of my oldest daughter's birthday month, where she had her first like real birthday party where it was more than just family and like had her school friends over.
How old did she turn?
5. She turned 5. And so that was so much fun to witness and get to be a part of. And yeah,
she's
we're just
old.
Doing life.
Time to get her a walker.
Well, she acts like she's old. She acts like a, you know, adult most of the time, but that's okay. It's good.
Would you say that was a highlight of your summer?
It was. It was one of the highlights. We really did have a great summer. Spent some time in Ohio with my wife's family. Had some conferences we were able to get away to together. Good stuff.
Nice. Well, today we're going to talk about these attachment styles that you love to speak on. And you're probably my favorite person to hear from on the subject. So will you talk to us a little bit about what they are and then walk us maybe through the different types? Give us all the goods. All the goods.
Yeah. Yeah. So the way I usually start this out is by saying everybody's got an attachment style. Nobody chose their attachment style. It's really easy to hear secure versus insecure attachment and think, oh, well, secure is the good one. And the other ones are the bad ones, right? It's really easy to just bring judgment on board right away, and I want to start from the get go here, just saying try not to get in that frame of mind.
Okay.
Try. A little different spin on it than what you may hear in some places. We'll get there. So everybody has an attachment style, and attachment styles begin developing actually before we're even born, like the third trimester. Infants in the womb begin to recognize the sound of their parents' voices and respond, whether that voice is loud and angry or calm and soothing. There's already some co-regulation happening even before birth. And so early on, we all begin to have these relational experiences. And as we have similar relational experiences over and over and over again, those begin to form these sort of templates in our mind for how relationships go. So let me give you an example. A baby cries, a parent comes over, soothes the baby, calms the baby, and the baby relaxes. That is a pattern, right? Or maybe a different baby, the baby cries, and as the baby gets upset, the parent gets upset. And as the baby gets more and more upset, the parent gets more and more upset. And the soothing, the attempts to soothe from the parent don't come from a still, grounded place. They come from a place of panic. That could begin to form a pattern. Or maybe a baby cries and really doesn't get much. Maybe gets kind of a surface level acknowledgement, a very sort of cold, you know, trying to meet whatever the immediate need is. Oh, I'll change you. Oh, here's your bottle. But nothing in terms of sort of an emotional attunement. That could become a pattern. All of these sorts of behaviors, what happens is the child begins to expect, oh, this is the way relationships go. And that becomes a template through which we then interpret relationships and strategize how we interact in relationships. Now, none of this is conscious. Okay, none of it is conscious. And so, so over time, over those first several years of life, these patterns have emerged. We've learned them. We've come to expect them. And we shape even who we think we are. Our own sense of identity is connected to this as well. Am I someone who has a voice? Does my voice matter? Am I worth being cared for or not? Those sorts of questions are answered through these relational patterns. So that's sort of the origin point of attachment styles. All right. And those three examples, and y'all can interrupt me at any point if you want to clarify anything. No? Okay. I'm going to keep going then. So those three examples I gave form three of the sort of primary attachment styles. So you've got secure attachment. And let me say this as well. When you're looking at attachment, there are usually two dimensions that we're really looking at. One is proximity. In other words, how close do I want to be? How close can I be in this relationship and be safe? And remember, close also includes far away. So how close or far away do I need to be okay and safe? So proximity. And then the other dimension is anxiety, but this is something that's often misunderstood about attachment styles. It's not generalized anxiety. It's a very specific anxiety that's in view here. And it is anxiety about abandonment. It's anxiety about whether or not the relationship is okay. So how anxious do I feel about us and the bond between us? So you overlay those with each other, and that's how we start to map out attachment. You were going to say something, Chris?
You said a couple things. I resonated with, excuse me, your example of I'm going to respond to you, but I'm going to give you the minimal. I'm going to give you just enough. Right. And then I'm going to check out. that happened in my childhood.
Yeah.
And I have an anxious attachment style.
Mm.
Or I'm trying to work my way out of an anxious attachment style. I'm intrigued by what you said at the top of the show about, you know, I've always thought I want to move toward the secure attachment. And I guess I'm going to learn something about that. But so is that, am I correlating that correctly? If there was some neglect or some lack in your childhood that you're not going to have, because abandonment was a huge issue for me.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It can go a number of ways. There's not always a one-to-one correlation. So some people, they experienced more of that abandonment, more of that distance, I would say, emotional distance or neglect, and they end up what's called preoccupied, where they're more anxious. Mm. Preoccupied, think of it like this. I'm preoccupied with the relationship. Are we okay? Are we okay? Are we okay? Are you mad at me? Are you okay with me? Do you understand me? Do you get me? Okay. That's the preoccupied. So in terms of those two dimensions I talked about, preoccupied people want a lot of proximity, but even in the proximity, they still have the anxiety, right? So I want to be close, but even when we're close, I'm anxious about you leaving. So anything that feels like distance, anything that feels like you're pulling away, or anything that feels like you're not attuned to me, you're misunderstanding me, you're not seeing me or hearing me, that's going to trigger a reaction. So all of the insecure styles have their own, what I call hair triggers, the things that just at the level of your nervous system, you're going to immediately get reactive. And for the preoccupied, more anxiously attached person, it's abandonment or misattunement. You're leaving me or you don't understand me. And when they get triggered, most of the time, those folks are going to go upward in intensity. They're going to start having more words and they're going to talk faster and their emotions are going to get bigger. Okay. Why? Because preoccupied attachment styles have a strong bias toward co-regulation. I'll be okay when I'm okay with you and you're okay with me. They struggle with self-regulation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I don't know why you're spying on me.
Hey, it's just the pattern, you know, it's just the pattern of how these things work. And now the opposite of that, on the other end of the spectrum, is what I call the dismissing or dismissive attachment style. Sometimes this is called the avoidant attachment style. So here, low proximity seeking. So I'm not trying to get close. And even in the lack of proximity, I don't outwardly display. Now that's key, and I'll circle back to that. Y'all help me remember to come back to that outward display phrase. But I don't outwardly display anxiety. So that's why it comes across very dismissive. Whatever. You're, okay, you're going to leave. Go. Fine. Go on. Right? It feels very flat, very cold, distant, avoidant. And those folks, their hair triggers are big emotions. Big emotions are very, very triggering, whether it's their own big emotions or someone else's big emotions, and anything that feels like shame or criticism. They're hypersensitive to anything that feels like shame or criticism. And their propensity is to go downward in intensity, low energy, go quiet, go numb, kind of check out, withdraw. They go slow. They think slow. And they'll do that until you corner them. And then they're like a cornered animal. Watch out. So those are the two sort of main flavors, I would say, of insecure attachment styles.
You know, what's rough about this is, you know, many couples, I don't know if you have found this, but I've found that a lot of addicts are often that avoidant personality, or all right, I'll just say it. Personally, my experience has been that I'm with an avoidant. I always felt like I was in a secure attacher because I can identify a need and I can speak a need and I can draw boundaries around a need. I just assumed that made me secure. I think that's the message that we get from the world. Like, if you can do those things, then you're solid, you're secure. And like you said, you're the good attachment. And now I'm beginning to wonder as we have this conversation. But something that you said, you know, about the dismissive avoidant, that they have big emotions. And I remember when I gave my ring back to Dan and showed him that I was leaving, zero emotion, just absolutely none, really triggered that abandonment piece for me. Later on through conversations, I'd come to find out, he's like, no, I've got big emotions. And I'm like, I don't believe you for one second. There's no emotion, you know,
there's just no display.
He would display nothing, and he'll continue to this day. You know, he's pretty avoidant. But he says that there's a lot of emotion there. And, so there is this cat and mouse game, I think, that we've played as a recovering couple of, I don't even know where I am now with this attachment stuff personally. And I think for me, it changes different. Does it change with one relationship to another? Like with my kids, it could be different.
Yes, it sure can. So you can, okay, this is going to get a little bit deep for a minute, but so we all have these things called internal working models of self and other. Internal working models of self and other, and they're always connected. So I have a certain internal working model of other, and then whichever internal working model of other, the other person, gets activated, the corresponding internal working model of self gets activated. So let me give you a couple of examples. So let's say you've got a kid who, whose father is overbearing and shaming and hypercritical, that kind of thing. So around men, okay, if being around men activates that particular internal working model of other, it might then activate an internal working model of self that is more withdrawn, quiet, want to be the wallflower, just try to fly under the radar, get through it, right? Versus maybe that same kid with mom was affirmed by performance and meeting needs, and right, that's going to activate a different internal working model of other, perhaps with women. And all of that can be related to attachment style. It doesn't have to be. There's overlap. It's not a one-to-one correlation. But what we do know specifically around attachment is there's a difference between what we would call a trait and a state. So my trait, attachment wise is my baseline. It's my default. It's a trait. Okay. It's stable across time. It's stable across relationships versus being in a state of, say, preoccupied attachment or dismissive attachment where something has happened, trauma. Okay. That creates this particular self state that when activated, my attachment style shifts. There was a 2019 study. Oh gosh, I always wonder. It's either 2019 or 2017. There was a 2019, though, I think, study of women who had experienced infidelity in their marriages. And what they found was that their attachment styles shifted as a result of discovering the betrayal. And it shifted in a way that's very particular. Now, we've talked a little bit about secure attachment. Come, be close. I'm fine with proximity. I'm not worried about you leaving. So that means you've got to go. That's okay, because I trust you'll come back, right? I miss you, but it's not a crisis. You're going to come back. That's secure. Then we talked about dismissive, whatever. You know, see ya. Not looking for the closeness. Not. And then the preoccupied. I want to be close. Are we okay? Are we okay? Okay. There's one more to talk about. And this is called a couple different things. I usually say fearful avoidant. It's also sometimes called disorganized. Same thing. There's just different terms for the same thing. That means I don't want proximity. So I don't seek proximity. Closeness feels dangerous, but I'm simultaneously afraid of abandonment. Okay. Think that through. What does that look like? Push, pull. Come here, go away. I hate you, don't leave me. Push, pull. Come here, go away. I hate you, don't leave me. And there is only one way that we know of that a person ends up with fearful, avoidant, or disorganized attachment. And that is when the person or people meant to be and who act as the source of comfort and security simultaneously become the source of threat and distress. Same person, source of comfort and security, threat and distress. Come here, go away. So at the level of my nervous system, I want it, but I don't. Right? And so think about a betrayed partner. Your nervous system, if you've been married for, you know, however long, whether it's 2 years or 20 years or 40 years, it doesn't matter. Your nervous system, when you pair off, you're wired. That's your person. That's who you go to, right? That's who you want comfort from the most. But this person, you just discovered they hurt you. So I don't want you, but I do want you.
Yeah, I want comfort, so I want to run to my person, but you're the one that hurt me, so now I want to run away. It's the worst double bind. I think that's why betrayed people feel crazy. One of the reasons why.
Yeah, and why their partners who betrayed them say, I can validate why they look at that and they go, I don't know what she wants from me. I do what she wants. And then that's the wrong thing. And then, you know, then I do what she wants and that's the wrong thing, right? Well, yeah, because her nervous system or his nervous system, whoever's betrayed, is going back and forth between, I need you. You're my person. Wait a minute. You're the person that hurt me. And some addicts, a lot of addicts actually have a fearful, avoidant attachment style to begin with. And one last thing I'll say about this, these all exist on a spectrum. So you can have a fearful avoidant style with a bias toward the dismissive, or fearful avoidant style with more of a bias toward the preoccupied, right? So like, you know, there's a lot of nuance here.
Okay.
I feel like you've given many of us, you've handed us a grace card. So the difference between the trait and the state, right? So like Chris is saying, this makes us feel crazy when we go through this. Well, I know by trait, by my default, I may not be one way, but in this state, in this scenario, I am another. Both exist.
Yes.
Both have a purpose. Both are okay. But if I did not know that. So I felt genuinely crazy. I thought I was going to be crazy because I was bouncing between what my default is and the current state of what was triggering, you know, my attachment. I think the other piece of the grace card that you just handed many of us is many of us who choose to stay. Why don't you leave? He did it again. How long are you going to keep doing this, girl? Because there's this, you know, other part, oh, that's abuse. If you just look at the other part, you know, so there's this narrative that goes through your head with all the things that come in you from the world that we live in, that the not wanting to seek proximity, but that, you know, go away, but I need you, go away, but I need you. So many that you handed me the grace card for that, because that helps me understand that, hey, yeah, it isn't just that you've been married 18 years and that you just keep allowing this thing to happen. No, this is deeply wired piece of me that is combined with the trait and the state. So it's not just easy to say, hey, girl, you deserve more, go get better. That is not what we're looking at here. So thank you for just handing that over to those of us that are in that journey.
Yeah. And I thank you. I mean, I'm grateful that you are receiving those grace cards, and I'll give you one more. I do a lot of education of this with couples that I work with, because I try to tell them this just is. It's easy. There's this thing called the law of moral attribution. Have you ever heard of that? The law of moral attribution is where there's something different between us, and I assign a moral value to what is different between us. And that can go either way. Like, I can put myself down and think I'm bad and you're good because of this difference, or vice versa. I'm good and you're bad because of this difference, which is usually the way we go. Right. And this happens a lot with attachment styles. So you've got the person who has that bias toward the preoccupied, toward the anxious. They really want the co-regulation. They want, I want to be seen. I don't want you to leave me. I want us together, right? And they look at the other person who gets quiet and withdrawn, and they don't show the big emotions, and they go, you're wrong for that. You don't care. Right? And the other way around, you know, the person from the dismissing place is looking at the one preoccupied and saying, you can't let it go. You have to keep bringing it up. You have, right? And what I tell my couples is, newsflash, you have different brains. You have different brains with different nervous systems. And it's not right or wrong. It's just different. And if you can, now let me be, I always am careful when I use the A word. If you can accept, which doesn't mean you don't expect for there to be growth. It doesn't mean that you put up with anything. It doesn't mean you start allowing that to be an excuse. But it's like, we're different. We're wired differently. Neither of us chose this wiring. When you can understand that about yourself and your partner, all of a sudden there's a clarity that comes, right? Okay, so if I know that my wife is very sensitive to anything that feels like abandonment or misattunement, here's what I can do. If it's a Saturday and we're both kind of working independently in the house, and I need to go run to Home Depot, there is a world of difference between me thinking, I'm just going to go to Home Depot and I leave, versus I find her and I say, hey, I got to run to the Home Depot. I'll be back in 30 minutes. Do you need anything? No. Okay. Right. Why? Is it wrong to leave without saying anything? Well, I mean, I don't think that's a moral issue. I don't think that's a sin issue, but I can, if I know I can care for my wife better, right? If I know that is a wounding for her or a trigger for her, and I can just do this one thing to tend to that hair trigger for her nervous system, why would I not do that? Because I love her, and guess what? It's better for me. It's better for me too. Or here's another, around the attunement piece, right? There's a difference between hearing her and giving her the felt sense of being heard. So she tells me something and I hear and I go, that's what.
Say that okay. Again. There's a difference between hearing her
and giving her the felt experience of being heard.
Whoa. Yes. Yeah.
You want to talk about soothing a nervous system. So if my wife says to me, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. I can't even come up with it. You know, hey, I'm really upset about this thing at work. I just don't think it should be that way. And I'm guilty of this. Okay. And especially now that my wife and I work together, it's like this happens, right? And she has the bigger emotions and she gets more, you know, expressive with those emotions than I do. It doesn't mean I don't have them, but you know, she's more expressive. And my tendency is to go internal, and I'm processing. I'm a slow internal processor. And if I hear her, but I just go right into my own internal processing, she doesn't feel heard. So what I can do is I can say, hey, so I hear you. You're saying, and I just reflect her words back. Yeah, you're really upset. That bothers you. That makes sense. Okay. She has a felt experience of being heard. She doesn't have to wonder then, what am I doing? Am I judging her for it? That's what usually comes between my wife and I. If I don't, what she makes up is I'm judging her for her bigger emotion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So that's how if I know this about her, I can choose to act accordingly. That's why, do we all want to get to a place where we have secure attachment? Sure. And that's called earned secure attachment, and it is possible. But you don't have to have a secure attachment style to function securely in a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good news.
Yeah. You learn these principles. You learn these principles of how to interact with each other, about yourself and about your partner, and you let the principles guide you. So the other direction there is, okay, I am wired as a more dismissive, avoidant person. That is my natural wiring. So I'm going to be much more sensitive to big emotions. okay? And anything that feels like shame or criticism. So for if you're partnered with someone like that, with me, here's a couple things that'll help you relate to your partner. Number one, use less words. I'm just telling you, you're more likely to actually be heard if you can, yeah, take the notes, Jen.
Jen's got her mic muted and she's got her notepad up front and center taking copious notes on screen, listeners.
This
is for my husband.
Okay. Yeah, for your husband. So,
No. I mean, I'm doing this for my husband. I'm taking notes.
Notes for Dan.
you come at him. You come at him at, you know, at a 9 out of 10 with 500 words. That is not setting you up for success. Okay. Now, listen. I don't say this to a betrayed partner when they're coming off a discovery and they're just angry and scared and all that. We're talking later on when we're really trying to finesse the relational dynamic here, but. I love it when I get to help partners experience this. I'm like, okay, I want you to say that same thing in 20 words or less. And they're looking at me like, how? I just take a minute. Just take a minute. Think about it. You got 20 words. Go. And they do. And he hears it and he receives it and he responds to it. It's so much more effective.
This is reminding me a little bit of love languages. Like, find out what your partner's love or your spouse's love language is. And then speak to them that way. And so, which leads me to my next question. Well, I'm going to rapid fire a couple at you.
Okay.
How is this important for us to know what our attachment style is and what our spouse's is? How do we find out what our attachment styles are? And then, a primary relationship like this, when we're kids, it's our parents probably, but this is such an important place for healing attachment wounds, right?
In the
marriage, the primary relationship, and in your in your business and in your model, the couple-centered recovery approach, you focus on couples healing together. So that's a lot. I hope you picked up what I laid down there. But how is this important?
Yeah.
How do we find out what we are and what our spouse is? And then how do we work on healing this within, you know, as we heal together as couples?
Yeah. So awareness is not sufficient for healing, but often necessary for healing. Self-awareness, awareness of myself, awareness of my partner, right? Knowledge is power, right? It's so trite, but there is a truth to it. There's a reason things are trite because there's a certain truth to it, right? And so when I know this about myself, or I know these things about my partner, that awareness sets me up to make choices that I can't make if I don't have the awareness. Okay. So if I am being driven by this programming unaware, non-consciously, I'm kind of doomed to just like play it out. Right. But when I have awareness, oh, wait a minute. Oh, this is shame coming up in me. Oh man, I'm getting really, really intense here. And I know how that affects my partner. Right. When I have that awareness, I suddenly have opportunities. Now I may choose not to do anything with it. I may say, you know what? This intensity is appropriate. And I might go right on with it, but I at least have a choice now. I at least have a choice, and choice is how we heal from trauma. Regaining choices is how we heal from trauma. Trauma takes choices away. Trauma takes choices away. Trauma is healed as we reclaim choices.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So
Can you give us a for instance on that?
Yeah.
My brain's
trying
to connect those dots. That's powerful. Good.
Yeah, absolutely. So like with a betrayed partner, and this is, I just want to say for any listeners who are at the beginning stages of your journey, like just shelve what I'm about to say for a while. Okay. Because if you're still just trying to get the bleeding to stop, you're still just trying to get your feet underneath you and figure out if you're safe.
Go back and listen to episode one of this podcast.
There you go.
Go back and listen to the Betrayal Survival Guide of this
podcast. There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Pause this one and save it for later. But if you're further along, you know, and you've got more or less that safety and stability in place, and now you're trying to like create a different relational dynamic. Okay. Okay. This is hard for some betrayed partners, I'm about to say, but your trauma is not an excuse for whatever you say or do. You are still responsible. Okay. Now, there are reasons, and a reason is different than an excuse. And this, I'm not saying this to condemn or to shame or whatever, but think about this. I've worked with betrayed partners and they so desperately want to heal, but they're trapped in their own narrative that I can't help it because he did this. I can't stop. I'm justified in this state, thinking this way, feeling this way, behaving this way, believing this way because of what happened to me. That is setting up what's called an external locus of control. You are not the author of your own story. Healing from trauma, especially the trauma of betrayal, happens when you say, I will decide what this means for me.
Whoa.
I will decide.
Yeah.
I will decide how my story ends. I will not be a victim to this. I will decide, which means I have to take responsibility. Okay. And that includes, okay, maybe I have the right to berate my partner in my pain. But here's what I ask betrayed partners. I get it. It's not fair. And maybe from a certain angle, you do have the right to do that. I don't dispute that. But my question for you is it getting you what you want? Is it effective? Does it work? Do you feel good afterwards? And usually when they're honest, they say, it doesn't work and I don't feel good afterwards. I say, let's try something different. Right? Mm-hmm. So the awareness, so awareness of these things, oh, this is why I do that. I'm sensitive to abandonment. I'm sensitive to misattunement, or I'm sensitive to shame or whatever it is. This is why I do it. That's why he does it. That's why she does that. I have that awareness. It puts me in a place to have choice, and choice is how I heal from the trauma. I'm going to decide who I'm going to be. I'm not going to let what happened to me dictate who I am. I know the kind of person I want to be. Okay. So that's why it matters, to get back to your questions, Chris. That's why it matters, because the awareness sets me up for choices. And choice means responsibility. I can't have choices without responsibility. Some people want the choice without the responsibility. That's not how it works. It's like with raising children, right? Freedoms increase as responsibilities increase.
That's right.
That's how it should be anyway, in my opinion.
Who much is given, much is required.
That's right. That's exactly right. So that's the why. The how to find out, there, you could go online, you can Google attachment style quiz. There's a ton of free ones out there. The Yurkoviches, who wrote How We Love, they have a pretty popular one out there that's online that couples can do. I think it's free. So there's lots of them out there, and the wording may be a little different. You know, you may talk about a vacillator or a pursuer, chaser. It's all talking about the same stuff. So that is one way to do it. I will say this though, that those are not always foolproof, because they capture a snapshot and they only capture your own self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So as a clinician, you know, there are certain things I'm watching for, I'm listening for, I'm observing in how a couple relates, that's actually telling me a whole lot more than whatever that self-report assessment probably did.
And attachment styles aren't static, they're dynamic. We're not stuck in this. Isn't something that God built into us. This is something we learned when we were young, and we can heal our attachment styles. Is that the proper wording?
I think so.
Okay.
They are dynamic. They do change. There is a, there may be some limitation to the degree of change that's possible, if that makes sense. You know, I think I will always carry that bias toward the dismissive avoidant. I just think I will. But I also think that I have earned secure attachment at this point. And so it's a both and, okay. You know? Yeah.
Like, yeah. I resonate with that. And then the primary relationship in the, what was the question? As we talk about couples working together, why is mm-hmm. marriage or that primary relationship such an important place for healing these attachment right. wounds?
Yeah. So the thinking used to be that family of origin work, healing of those relational wounds had to happen separately, right? And so you don't do that in marriage therapy. You go off, you do family of origin work individually, you go to an intensive, this, that. And I do think there's a place for that. So I mean, I do family of origin intensives with groups of all men or all women, you know. So I don't hear me as saying there's not value in doing that work individually, but absolutely 100%. All of this comes up in that primary relationship, in a marriage, and that becomes a context for healing. And I'll give you, you know, an example. Let's take an example where, say, there's a wife who has a real wound around being left out. Maybe early in her life, she was kind of on the outside. She was the black sheep. She was held at a distance from her parents. So she's got this real sensitivity to feeling left out. Okay. Then she gets married. Her husband betrays her. And all these other people know, all these other acting out partners know things. She was left out. And so it's like the wound from the betrayal, the way it is interpreted, it exacerbates this wound from early on, right? A different partner who didn't have the left out wound might be a not enough wound, or it might be a, you know, too much wound, or whatever, right? But we interpret the meaning we make about the betrayal is often informed by our prior wounding, the stories that are already there. We start to interpret the betrayal in a way that reinforces what's already there.
So true.
What if okay? you can't remember? I mean, we know that this comes up, you know, subconsciously, if you will. But mm-hmm. if you're doing this type of work with somebody, what if they can't yeah. remember their childhood? Like, how do you resolve okay. that?
You don't have to. It can be helpful to, but you don't have to. I will say this though, if you can't remember your childhood, there's a pretty good chance you don't remember it because you experienced a lot of neglect.
Okay.
So that's probably the wound, if there's not a lot of memory. Yeah. So, so like with this example of the wife who has the left out wound. So now in recovery, if her husband knows she's got this wound of feeling left out, and he doesn't just seek to not leave her out, but beyond abstaining from behaviors that would reinforce the damage, he goes beyond that to actually proactively introducing behaviors that go against that old wounding and that old message of including her, of bringing her in. It really does become an opportunity to heal the wound that goes all the way back to childhood. Because what's happening, and this happens in any good therapy relationship or coaching relationship or in a marriage that is trying to heal, this other person, whether it's the therapist or the coach or my partner in marriage therapy, becomes the new internal working model. When they start showing up differently, I'm expecting them to leave, but they stay. I'm expecting them to criticize, but they validate. Right? It's jarring to the system at first. And a lot of betrayed partners are skeptical, and understandably so. And so that's why we always say consistency over time. But what's happening there is there's an adjustment in this internal working model of other, which is going to cause an adjustment of the internal working model of self.
That's good.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of all these times that Dan came up to me. I'm like, don't come at me with that calm, cool, collected, understanding.
Yeah.
Like, it just started to become more irritating because he was doing all the things right after doing all the things wrong. Yeah. And, but I can see how that consistency that you spoke of over time, yeah. I've come to know that to be a part of him now. And he has consistently used that over the last 13 years to help heal some of those attachment, pieces between the two of us.
Yeah. There you go. That's it.
How does this intersect with faith? Like, is there a faith component in all of this?
I'm so glad you asked me that. And I can't even talk about this without getting emotional. Yeah. So salvation is about attachment to God, to be in Christ, to be one with him, which doesn't mean, you know, it's not like the Eastern spirituality of, you know, union with God, like we're absorbed into some big cloud of divinity. We're still us and God's still God. I'm still me and God's still God. I never lose my identity, but I am one with him. I am in Christ, right? I'm in the hand of the Father. He is the perfect Father. He will never leave me or forsake me. It is totally about attachment. And one thing I did not say early on this conversation is that secure attachment is developed through the experience of rupture and repair, which is weird when you first hear that. It's like, wait a minute. What I'm saying is you cannot develop secure attachment if you never experience ruptures in the attachment.
Okay. Explain, please.
If I set up my life, my wife and I could have set up our lives in such a way that we were always with our children. Sleep right outside their crib, walk right behind them so they can't fall, spoon feed them every bite so they can't choke, right? Like always with them. They never experience rupture from us. That would not create secure attachment. Why? They would always fear what would happen if we left.
Oh.
The secure attachment is formed when they wake up, they're alone in their crib. Where's mama? Where's daddy? They cry, we come. They're out there walking in the backyard. They fall down and scrape their knee. They cry, we come. Right? Like, it is the consistency. It's that we are so consistent that we are there when they fear that we're not. We are there. We step in. And when they get angry, we're still there. And when they get sad, we're still there. And when they mess up, we're still there. So it's the rupture and repair that develops the security.
That is, and a simple example of that would be the game of peekaboo. They go away, they come back. They go away, they come back.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Now, what is the gospel? Rupture and repair.
Yes.
Rupture.
Ooh, whole body chills.
And repair. Okay. We are ministers of reconciliation. Be reconciled to Christ. Our sin has separated us from God. We're separated by our sin, separated by our shame. We sinned in the garden, and then what did we do? We hid ourselves from each other and from God. And here comes God. Where are you? Where are you? Not because he didn't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he comes and he seeks and he sends his son to call us to himself. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest. It is a call to be reconciled after rupture. And what the beauty of it is that what we have after the repair is better than what could have been there before the rupture. And this is what our couples experience too. When after the devastation of betrayal and the rupture that occurs, when they can truly heal and repair, they have something better than.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. I can attest to that.
This is the gospel.
Yes. Yeah.
This is the gospel. 100%.
Even if the better isn't in, like, my husband could relapse. I can relapse into old, you know, habits and patterns I swore I'd never go back to, right?
True.
But the security comes in, I think, the work, the healing that's taken place in me, which then, as an individual, which then affects the coupleship, right? But you were about to say something, please.
Well, yeah, I'll respond to that, and then I'll say what I was going to say. You're exactly right. what happens so often is people have a rupture, but they have like a, what I call, I got this from one of my first therapists, a woman from deep East Texas. She said, that's a 50 cent reaction to a nickel problem. So when we have a 50 cent reaction to a nickel problem, it's because I'm not just reacting to the actual rupture that happened there. I'm reacting to the history of not being able to repair. So when I have confidence in our ability to repair, I can right size my reaction. It doesn't have to be a big deal, or it can be as big a deal as it needs to be and no bigger. Right. And in the same way, it's like with God, you know, I fall into sin. There just should be a reaction, but it's not the reaction of he hates me. He's going to leave me. He's going to throw me into hell. He's going to, right? No, it's a right size reaction. What I was going to say is this conversation reminds me of one of my favorite songs. It's by a Christian artist named Andrew Peterson.
I love him. Super well known.
You know Andrew Peterson?
Yes.
I do too.
His Arizona song is just the best road trip song ever. Yeah.
I think he's brilliant. I think he's absolutely brilliant. He's got a song called Thank Someone for This. It's like 10 and a half minutes long. It's very, very long. And it's all about like, you can feel in your bones there's something wrong in the world, but there's someone's beauty and all that. At the very end, this is the verse. He says, and when the world is new again, and the children of the king are ancient in their youth again, maybe it's a better thing to be more than merely innocent, but to be lost and redeemed by love.
Wow.
Let me say this. Sorry, because I know we got to wrap up. But what this means is that this is hard for a lot of people to take, and some people are going to disagree with me theologically. That's okay. Everyone's allowed to be wrong. But
they'll change God, their notes when they go up, right?
That's right. God has no plan B. Rupture and repair was his plan from the beginning. He is doing and working something beautiful. He wants something better for you if we'll receive it. That is the gospel of attachment, that there's something better after rupture.
Yes. Okay. Thank God for Kleenex. I'm feeling that emotion right along with you. I heard a quote the other day. I wouldn't take $1 million to go through what I just went through again, but I wouldn't take $2 million to go back and be the person I was.
That's right. That's good.
Yeah. Rupture and repair. So good. Okay. Yeah. You answered why it's so important for us to understand our attachments and how to love our spouse well, even our, you know, others well with this and the gospel of attachment. That was so good. Were you a preacher before this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought so. I thought I remembered reading something about that.
Yeah. 13 years. I was a pastor.
Do you miss it?
Yeah. Although I will say, I just last month was installed as a lay pastor at my church,
which is
a wonderful story of God's redemption and grace. Cause I didn't think that was going to be a part of my life anymore.
Wow.
That's so cool. That is
congratulations.
So cool. You said God wants something better for us if we're willing to receive it and look at what he's doing in your life now as a result of that.
Well,
thank you.
All grace.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I know you've got some people to go help right now, so we're going to wrap this up, but thank you for joining us again. We'd love to have you back. I feel like
anytime.
We could talk about attachments longer. I'm going to stop and end with a quote by Kurt Thompson. Each of us is born into this world looking for someone looking for us. So thank you for helping us to understand ourselves a little bit better, these attachment styles, and for the education you just gave us. This was rich and wonderful. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Until next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast. We hope you found today's discussion helpful and empowering. For more information, please be sure to check the show notes. Until next time, be kind to yourself and keep pursuing healing. A ministry supported by Pure Life Alliance.